Hey, what's up, you guys? You're listening to another episode of Nick Talk. I'm your host, Nikki James, and today I have an American actor on my show. He's most known for his reoccurring role on NYPD Blue. He also has a reoccurring role on several other things. He's got such a resume that it's hard for me to even say it in this intro. But what I can tell you is that he's an actor, he's a director, he's a writer and a teacher. He's also a father. And where he finds the time to do all of these things, I do not know. But we're going to talk to him about it without any further ado. Ladies and gentlemen, my guest, this is Michael B. Silver. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Nikki. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. Fabulous intro. Thank you.
Thank you. I know I had a little trouble with it at first, but the reason is there's so much that you have going on. I'm really impressed. And
well, that's so sweet. A lot of it is out of necessity. You know, when you're going for long periods of time, keeping a career going with longevity, mm-hmm. Sometimes you got to spread out. And I think of myself more as kind of a storyteller than I do as specifically just an actor. So, you know, for me, the writing and the directing and even the teaching, really, they all go hand in hand.
Wow.
And, whatever's kind of popping the most at that moment or whatever project that I'm working on or pushing forward, you know, that's where my focus is. But I've been bouncing around for a long time. I think that's why it's so long at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Speaking of bouncing around, you were bouncing around last night for a little bit, weren't you?
Yeah, we had an amazing time last night. So I co-hosted this national virtual poker tournament for the Children's Tumor Foundation last night. Mm-hmm. And, I do a lot of work with them. My nephew, Joe Jaffa, has neurofibromatosis, which is a really difficult neurological disorder where you grow tumors anywhere in your body on nerve endings, and that can be inside your body or outside your body or anywhere. So, it's a really difficult disease, and they're really making strides right now. The foundation, the CTF Foundation, there's a lot of amazing research going on and therapies and treatments, and it's the first time that they're really kind of trying to get a handle on this thing. And so public awareness is important, as well as funding for for the research and stuff. So last night we threw a great poker tournament. I had like a whole bunch of, a lot of people showed up and a bunch of celebrities, and a lot of fun was had. And it was just a really great, great feeling. And then, of course, with the poker, everyone gets crazy. And, we went till, 1:30 in the morning, and, it was just a blast. Everyone was really great last night.
Oh, wow. That had to have been great networking too, huh?
You know, it was fun. A lot of these people who I brought together, I didn't really know them. Some of whom some are close friends, and some I've worked with, or some I've reached out to. But it's fun when you have there's Mark Feuerstein sitting at a table with, Joel McHale, and Ben Shankman comes in, and then David Constable takes all of their money. It's just it was a really fun, fun group of people, and people like Jason Alexander, who was there, and Gina Hecht, who was there. Like, those guys are serious poker players. They've been to the World Series, and they play in serious tournaments. So to have them come last night was really, amazing. And also Phil Gordon, who's a pro, and I think if he hasn't won the main event, he's been at the final table. But he's an old pro and a teacher. He was there last night and kind of helping host. And Norman Chad was there. A bunch of cool poker players showed up too. It was just a great event, and it was for a wonderful cause. And, I think the foundation raised more money than they expected to, which was just, so wonderful. It's been really hard during COVID. Everyone's a little bit nervous, and companies don't want to give out a lot of money, and people are afraid to, buy tickets to charity stuff these days. And that's understandable because, the future's so uncertain, and it's just a difficult time for everybody. Everyone's kind of struggling. So, to have that kind of turnout last night was really a beautiful thing. And I think it made everyone feel good too, to be, in a community of sorts and, doing something good again.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah. And people need that, like you said. So, well, congratulations.
I think so. I think, it was just nice to have people come together and it was all towards a wonderful cause, but just the feeling of like, hey, how you doing? And let's play. And, how's your game going? There were a few breaks where we got to kind of talk to each other and ask some questions and stuff. It was just really nice to be a part of a community after being isolated for so long.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So are they going to do it again? Do you have, is there going to be like a poker tournament?
Most definitely. You know, there's been a bunch of tournaments, both in New York and LA. This is the first one that was kind of national because we could do it virtually and everyone could sit at the same tables. Wow. But there's certainly going to be a lot more poker tournaments coming up, both virtual and you know, and New York and LA, I think mostly.
All right. Well, you'll have to keep me posted on that, and
I will. You know, I just want to say that the foundation does a lot of different stuff besides just poker tournaments. They have all kinds of events all year long between, you know, fashion shows and, you know, run-a-thons and walk-a-thons and all kinds of great, you know, ways to, you know, to raise public awareness and raise funds. And so anyone who's interested should go to ctf.org, which is the Children's Tumor Foundation.org. It's an amazing organization. I just want to plug it.
Yeah, no, great cause. I love it. Speaking of national and LA and New York, let's talk a little bit about the New York side of you. I know you were born there, weren't you?
Yeah, I was born in New York City. I went to school in the city, and then right after college, I moved out to LA. But all my family and all my friends, at least to the point when I moved, I'm definitely a New Yorker at heart. There's no question about that. I think the city's taken a real hit in the past year. I know a lot of people have. There's been an exodus, and obviously a lot of shops and stores have closed down and stuff. I think as the spring, I'm hoping as the spring comes and feels like there's some light at the end of the tunnel here, that maybe the city starts to bloom again. You know, it got hit really hard, I think, right off the bat.
And even, I was thinking, especially because of all the cases that were happening over there with COVID and like you said, the businesses, but the business of acting and writing and directing and the whole entertainment industry, I'm sure that took a big hit as well. And I know you come from a long line of filmmakers and screenwriters, don't you?
I do. Yeah. My grandfather was a real mogul out here in the 30s and 40s. He was an Oscar winning writer and a producer, and he kind of ran Columbia under Harry Cohen, I think, back in the day. He was also an organizer, and he co-founded the Screenwriters Guild a long, long time ago. And so he was very political. In fact, he got in big trouble for his politics, he and my grandmother, and he was blacklisted in the early 50s and ended up leaving, disgraced and enraged and, kind of left it all behind. So, there was an abrupt ending to all that, I think. Mm. I think he moved to France and ended up writing under a pseudonym in the 60s, but never really, found the success that he had had. And I think he was sort of bitter. But then, years later, my sister moved out here. My older sister moved out here, and she wrote a script in film school called The Hand That Rocks the Cradle.
Yeah.
And so she blew up right out of film school. And I was still in high school. I couldn't wait to get out of school and come out to LA and follow in her footsteps and kind of, carry on the family tradition.
Yeah. Was your grandfather, was he in New York or was he a Los Angeles native?
No, he was a Duluth, Minnesota native, but he wrote some plays in the 20s, 1920s. In New York, and got some acclaim, and then got brought out to Los Angeles, and was very smart and a great writer, and just a really amazing person. And he rose really, really quickly, and I think he had a lot of influence and friends, and I never really got to know that side of him. I knew him as a little kid when he was a great grandfather to me.
Yeah.
But the stories I've heard, and certainly throughout my time here, I've run into people. And especially in the early days when I first got out here, because it's a long time ago.
Right.
But some people who knew who he was, who had known him, and there was just an amazing, intense, feedback about how warm and how much grace he had, and how much what a great guy he was. I guess
I feel like that would be a good movie. Just like your grandfather's life sounds like it would be. It sounds like he's done so much.
I'm just touching the iceberg. I hope my sister's listening to this, because she's an amazing, extremely high level triple A list screenwriter. And I really want to write my grandfather's story with her, because I feel like, my grandmother too, both of them were incredible people ahead of their time. And had all kinds of horrible, challenges and struggles to get through, but also were so, you know, achieved so much and were so successful in some ways, and then kind of, I guess, miserable in others. But that's what makes a good story.
Huh? Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's a great story. We have to write the story before it's all said and done.
So I was doing a little bit of research on you, Michael, and I did see that that your sister was also she was a writer, and then I know her husband does some stuff. Your whole family is kind of in this whole industry, and
I think it kind of skipped a generation. I think both my parents were frustrated storytellers and never really got around to it. Mm. But certainly, we were raised in a environment where, at a very early age, we were dragged to films, in the theater, all kinds of old revival places. There were some great places in the 70s and 80s in New York, where you could go and see, you know, they'd have a festival of Jimmy Stewart, or they'd have a festival of, you know, Frank Capra or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I guess by the time I was, I don't know, early teens, I had seen my education in film had been enormous. And, and we were also kind of in awe of my grandfather. His Oscar is now sitting on my mantle, and I grew up, looking at it and making my Oscar speech with his Oscar in my hand. So, you know, it was always something that I felt at a very young age. You know, I remember watching a Charlie Chaplin movie when I was, I think, 5 or 6. And I remember it was the end of, I think it was City Lights, because at the end of City Lights, the woman he loves is a flower seller on the street, right? She's poor. Yeah. And she's blind, and he's madly in love with her, and she loves him. And he finds the money, you know, he's a tramp, right? He's a bum, and he finds the money to get her the eye operation that she needs, mm-hmm. but he doesn't tell her. He gets her the money for the eye operation, and at the end of the movie, now she can see, but he's afraid that she won't love him anymore because he's just a tramp and because he's Charlie Chaplin. And so now he's scared to let him know it's him after she can see. And so he goes to buy a flower from her, and she touches his hand and realizes who he is. Oh. And I just remember, and, you know, of course she loves him still. And I remember laughing at how beautiful he was, but also crying at how moving that was. Wow. And I was like 6. I was tiny. I think I was like half under the seat, but I remember that moment and thinking just what an incredible thing was happening to me emotionally, laughing and crying at the same time. But also that, like, something in me felt like I want to do that. It was something that I felt like I could do or wanted to do or was drawn to, mm-hmm. In terms of that storytelling. I wanted to make people feel the way I was, you know, feeling at that moment. And I was tiny. So I think I've always had that, you know, that need to do that. Maybe I discovered it then, or maybe it was born then, but I also wonder sometimes if I'm just sort of like still chasing this, you know, 6-year-old moment that I had this epiphany in, and I'm still chasing it.
Right. Yeah. I was wondering, because I had, you know, I'd read that, you know, you had come from, you know, a long line of filmmakers, and I read about your grandfather, and I know your family, and like you said, there's a miss in the generational, you know, just whatever industry that you guys are in.
Yeah.
I was wondering, do you think that that maybe you were led in that direction, or do you think it was definitely like your choice to be an actor, well, to be in this field?
I think it's all a combination of things. I mean, hopefully it's in my blood somewhere, and I got those genes, or I got that, you know, the blood of a storyteller somewhere, of an artist maybe. Yeah. But I also think that, you know, I think that my exposure to it, I think watching how much it turned on my dad, how excited he was to show me, you know, Deliverance and Clockwork Orange when I was 9 years old. Mm-hmm. Even if the movies were inappropriate or terrifying or maybe scarring in some ways, just sharing it with my dad and my sister, who was a part of that. Yeah. You know, my mom was part of it too, a little bit, but it was really driven by my dad. You know, the stories of my grandfather, and just appreciating, you know, in the 70s when I was growing up, you know, all these amazing, iconic golden age of cinema, you know, movies were happening. And so to watch, you know, whatever it was, whether it was Young Frankenstein or Taxi Driver, mm-hmm. you know, I think that I was, something in me was drawn to it, to the stories themselves and the people who were telling those stories, but also to my dad and to the fun we'd have talking about it, or, you know, I'm not sure exactly where it came from, but I would hope that it's a, you know, combination of all of it. I think that's what life is.
And I know that you went to college at Brown University. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Was that for acting or writing, or what was your major?
You know what? I didn't have a whole lot of thought as to what I was doing other than I had to achieve. In high school, it was all about just getting into the best college I could get into. Like I said, I knew that I wanted to come out to LA and tell stories. But it was also, I just grew up in an environment in New York at that time, and more so now, by the way, where there's just a push to get into the best schools and achieve the most you can and make the most money. And so I didn't think a lot about it. I just kind of worked hard and got into a pretty good school. And once I was there, I realized, oh, wait a second, what do I want to be doing with my life? And how is this ever going to help me?
Yeah.
And so, the answer is, I'm not sure. I mean, I certainly took some courses at Brown that helped me, some great acting teachers that were interesting, and some writing classes, some film classes. I took some classes, some semiotics classes at RISD, which is Rhode Island School of Design, which is on the same hill as Brown. Really interesting teachers and professors, very artistic, and a lot of interesting people and fun parties and stuff. I think I got as much out of college from the fraternity and the social life, the girlfriends that I learned from, all kinds of experiences. But, I was a Soviet history major, to be honest with you. I'm not sure why. I never wanted to teach history. I was interested in history. And while I was at school, the Soviet Union was collapsing day by day, and it was in the newspapers and it was happening. So I just felt like, this is a moment in history that I could be studying while it's happening. And so I gravitated towards that. But I had a film minor and an acting minor. And I did a lot of things. I played lacrosse, and I joined a lacrosse fraternity and did a lot of that stuff. And then midway through, I realized I didn't quite want to only be a jock. And it was there was no way to be a jock as well as other things. It was not a full-time job. So
yeah.
I kind of backed out of that and then ended up doing a lot of theater and, had friends across the board in different places.
Yeah. Did you start your acting classes when you were younger, or did you wait till you got to LA?
No, I took some stuff when I was young. I wanted to start acting at a very young age, and my parents wouldn't let me. And I think at some point they let me go in a few commercial auditions, and I realized very quickly that that was no fun and it wasn't glorious or sexy or anything. It was just annoying, and I wanted to be at playing ball or whatever. But summertime, I would go to some theater camps and some drama classes, after school, and I did some plays here and there. Certainly in college, I leaned into it a lot more. I was playing saxophone in high school, and I was trying to achieve at school. I was playing football and baseball and a lot of, chasing girls and stuff. And so, for me, I didn't get serious until I got out of school. I mean, I see a lot of young people now, I teach a lot of young people who are so driven and so clear about what they want and how they're going to go about their business. And they're 19.
Yeah.
And for me, it was really in my mid 20s when I was I put the beard down for a second and sort of, tried to focus on okay, what am I really here to do and how do I do it?
Right.
And I got into a great, great class out here, but it took me some time, and I'm really impressed by young people who are able to put it all together right now and get so focused. I think there's more pressure these days on kids, even athletically, sort of specializing and looking at what do you want to be doing rather than just having a smattering of different interests. I don't know.
Did your whole family move over to LA when you did?
No, my sister, my grandfather and grandmother moved out in the 50s, right? And so they were done with LA, and they were bitter and angry. And, my parents sort of, we always looked down on Los Angeles a little bit.
Okay.
And certainly, New Yorkers looked down on everybody, I think, a little bit. But my sister came out, and once she blew up and I was about to graduate, I was like, I couldn't wait to just, get out here and start my career. It looked easy because she was my sister's super smart, and she sort of hit right off the bat when she was, 22.
Yeah.
And so it looked like it was going to be easy. So I was like, get me out of school. Let's go.
Nice. So I know some of your early stuff was pretty cool. I know one of your, I don't know if it's your earliest, I don't know what your earliest was, but I do know that a pretty popular one is Jason Goes to Hell.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that I can't believe how popular that is still, 25, almost 30 years later.
Yep.
So Jason Goes to Hell was a fascinating gig because I had grown up on the Friday the 13th movies. And like when I was in middle school or maybe ninth grade, the first one came out and we were just obsessed. So we watched them all and I was a huge fan, and I was in an acting class in Los Angeles and there was a casting director there, there was a casting director in that acting class. It was a very intense class. And I think he was there to kind of, learn about actors and how to talk to them maybe, and how to get better performances out of them. He was a really brave person. I've never seen casting directors put themselves in the crosshairs in that way. And it was all for him to sort of learn about, you know, what he was doing, which I really admired in him. Anyway, at some point he had cast Friday the 13th, Jason Goes to Hell Part 9. Mm-hmm. And I think they were finished with it, and they needed to add in another storyline. And it was, it was a sexy storyline, and it was more like blood and, sex is what they were basically looking for. Mm-hmm. And I was 23 and I hadn't done a movie, and I was a huge fan of the stuff. And, I was in great shape, and I didn't care. Yeah. And they put me with a couple I got cast in it with a couple ladies who I knew. Mm-hmm. And I was close with and comfortable with, and it was a really fun experience because we were all we all just decided we were just going to go for it and have fun with it and not overthink it, which we did. And there were some awkward, naked cold moments, but we kind of hung together and got through it. And I learned a lot about the way that those things happen and how not sexy love scenes are and how not scary death scenes are, and all the things that you imagine when you're watching it. Right. But it was an incredible job. And then of course, it's been a cult classic, and I just keep, people are just always interested in it. And, so many documentaries and podcasts about it. It's incredible.
Wow. Yeah. That one stuck out to me like a sore thumb when I was reading all of your work. Now, when I was reading all of your work, I started just, I read a few, and then I kept scrolling down. And I was like, and then I kept scrolling, and then I just decided to scroll really fast just to see if I could get to the bottom. And it took me forever. You have been in so many things. Like, how do you find the time? Is your phone just ringing off the hook?
Well, no, but I'm old, so there's been a lot of years to fill with jobs. A very tiny percentage of actors actually have like work lined up and jobs stacked up and, and go from job to job to job. The vast majority, either don't work or are journeymen like me, where you just keep swinging the bat. Mm-hmm. And some jobs are, some jobs are better than others, and some jobs have potential to really turn into something exciting, which has happened. And, plenty of jobs that you thought were going to be super exciting or bump you up to the next level or three levels or whatever, don't happen or don't get picked up, or you get cut out of the movie, or, so many moments for an actor, there's possibility. I've done almost a dozen pilots, I think. And so, when those things don't happen, what I've learned over the years, I guess, and what I teach my, my classes is that you have to, you feel that heartache and you feel the pain of it. Mm-hmm. And then you find something else productive to throw yourself into. And, you take another swing at the bat. There's always another audition. Yeah. There's always another job coming. Mm-hmm. And when there's not, there's a lot of, proactive work that you can be doing. That's, whether it's, upgrading your representation or writing your play or your pilot or making a short film or making your reel better. Like, there's just so many ways to, to stay brilliant and stay positive and, keep hoping, because there's always another job. So, I feel really blessed and lucky that I've worked so much and I've been so busy, and, I met so many incredible people and had incredible experiences.
Right.
And I also fight the famous actor, urge to, of self-loathing because my expectations are always far higher than whatever, I'm achieving at that moment.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about, if you think people can make I was going to ask you your view on actors making a living at, like you kind of said, like just swinging the bat, Do you think that's a sustainable job if you don't?
It's a hard job to sustain over the decades. I mean, it's really a hard job to stay with because it's personal work, and it's, you know, when you're being rejected, you're being rejected physically, I think for the head bone, it's a really tough thing to do. And also financially, it's like there were great times and there were times where things get a little tight. And, I think you always need to be working on your craft. I think you always need to be working on yourself and, and sort of making sure that what you're, you know, as you grow and you evolve, your casting changes and what you're able to do, what you're not, you know, what your challenges were, often change as you mature and grow and learn more about yourself. And, you know, I think there's a lot of work on yourself that you do. And I think it's also important to, you know, also another famous actor thing is just the narcissism, to sort of, you know, to forget yourself and go and give or go and teach or whatever it is that's like not about you, that's about creating or giving or connecting with things that are other than like your career and your jobs and your agent, which is addictive, you know, which is a difficult thing for actors to get over.
Yeah.
The need to be loved, the need to be relevant, the need to be, you know, admired or whatever it is. And just keep your focus on the work, keep your focus on the stories that you're telling and whether they're your stories or somebody else's, and, you know, keep reading plays and reading writers. There's so many great writers out there today, as you know, in TV, especially, that should be reading scripts and, you know, and also in some sort of class to be, you know, to be executing and keeping yourself, you know, polished when you're not actually out there working.
Yeah. Can you remember a time back in your, when you were going through acting classes, a time that stuck out to you that really changed kind of how you acted?
Ooh, that's a great question. Did you say a time in my acting class?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. When I came out here, I was in an amazing class, at the Beverly Hills Playhouse. And, there's an actor named Jason Begay who's on, I guess he's on Chicago. I think he's on Chicago, PD maybe. Okay. One of the Chicago shows. Anyway, he's the lead and he's an incredible guy and an incredible actor. And I remember I was doing an improv with him on stage and Milton Gonzalez was the teacher, who was, an incredible intuitive teacher and a very powerful person and, you know, somewhat controversial, but really taught me a lot about acting and about art in general. Anyway, he had us doing this improv and it was me and Jason and another girl were sitting at a table and the improv wasn't going well. It was sort of, it was just stalled and everyone was forcing it. No one was listening to each other and it was just a mess. And at some point Jason just took the table and flung it up in the air. And there was a whole dinner on the table, by the way.
Oh, no.
And he just flung the whole thing up in the air. And I was so shocked by that moment and by the choice that Jason made in that moment. Just, there was no reason for it. So it was an arbitrary, you know, moment that didn't feed the story that we were telling. But from that, it spurred an incredible improv exercise that ultimately got some sort of, you know, like a standing ovation or whatever the equivalent is, you know. And I just remember meditating on the fact that the moment that you feel like you're not in yourself or following impulses or present with what's around you, do take some action, even if it's wild, you know, he was just a wild guy and he would do crazy things, but just to take action and not to sit there and sort of watch yourself. And that really taught me a lot about, you know, for me, acting is, you know, 80% or 90% listening and being present with those around you and forgetting yourself and getting lost in what you're doing rather than, you know, trying to manufacture something that you've thought of in your head would be a great, clever, interesting moment.
Right.
To trust yourself and to just be present and that'll play and that'll be enough.
Yeah.
That was a great lesson. I learned a lot of great lessons in that class.
Oh, that's great. As I interview people and celebrities, as I've done it throughout the years, one of my favorite things to ask people is your favorite role, your most embarrassing moment, and the biggest frustration moment. So I'd love to hear about a moment for you. We'll start with embarrassing. Did you have you ever had the?
Oh my God!
What is your most embarrassing moment?
We're talking about on set, right?
On set, yeah.
Okay, good. My most, that's a great question. I think it has to be, I was working on ER, right? I was recurring on the show ER, which was a huge hit in the 90s and, and early aughts, I guess. And it was an early job for me. I was young. I was nervous. It was a hit show already. And I was playing young Dr. Myers. And the director told me to banana my way down the hall. And so I kind of had a nice idea what it was. I thought he was kidding at first, and then he wasn't. And then I was like, okay. And I was 23, and I was like, okay. And everyone, you know, it's a big set, and Clooney's there, and, you know, everyone's there. So I was like, okay, yeah. So I did the thing, and obviously I didn't quite understand the note or execute the note, whatever it was. But I remember the AD, who's the assistant director, came, and there's like 50 to 100 people standing around, comes with a banana in his hand and holds it up and screams at me that, like, I didn't quite banana. Do I see the banana? Do I understand what a banana looks like? And But I'll never forget that moment when the guy held the banana up and everyone just stared at me like oh, that was no. terrible.
Oh,
terrible
no.
moment. I was very embarrassed.
So, okay, for clarification purposes, what does it mean to banana down a hallway?
So rather than walking straight, right, if you kind of walk in the shape of a banana so that, you know, the camera can't really tell, depending on where the camera is, right? I think the camera's like way behind me, and it had to see over my shoulder to whoever was the central part of that shot or whatever. And so I had to kind of move my way to the right side of the hall and then back to the left side of the hall while I was walking, just to help the camera movement or whatever the flow of the thing was. There's a lot of like walk and talks on that show where you walk through the set and you're like, you know, they join five scenes in a row. Oh, another terrible moment was on ER was, you know, they join five scenes in a row. So they say action, and it's like, I don't know, it's 6 minutes before they get to you because they're doing walking through different rooms and hallways. They're not cutting. They're just, you know, on a steady cam telling different stories as they move. And then and then 6 minutes in, they're like, here they come. And the camera's rolling, and they roll right into my thing. And I totally had no idea what to say. I just froze.
Oh, no.
And so everyone has to go back to one, and there's like 100 people have to reset everything and do the shot again. And I mean, it was probably a result of the banana because I was always on edge on that set. I was terrified.
Oh no. You know what? Thinking about how they have to do that. And, you know, you see some music videos that are all done in one shot and, you know.
Yeah. Crazy. No, it just takes a lot of, you know, it's like a ballet. It takes a lot of rehearsal and then a lot of like people working together to help one another. And, you know, and then there's 20 rehearsals to make sure it's right. And then you go for it and then I screw it up.
Yeah. Oh, man. All right. Yeah. So what about maybe a moment where you had your biggest frustration? Like the first thing that comes to mind. Yeah.
Biggest frustration. You know, every time you do a pilot or you know, something that looks like it's about to bloom or blossom into something else that's much larger than you, you know, and then it doesn't go. That's I don't know if it's frustration, but that's a deep disappointment. It's a real loss. You know, you really grieve over something that's not just about like, oh, the money I could have made or whatever, but you make a family when you're making a pilot and everyone is sort of not only on the same team and the same mission moving forward, which you have on every job, which is a lot of what attracts me to this business is just the families that we make and the, you know, the circus that comes together and, you know, and everyone's out for this common goal. Yeah. But also just the anticipation of where things are leading and how these storylines are going to develop and all the talk that goes on set about what's going to happen in episode 2 or 5 or 9 or 19. Mm-hmm. And then it doesn't happen. That's a real frustration. I've also had a bunch of projects that I've written and put together that almost came to fruition or we almost got on set or the money fell out or whatever it is. But, you know, the star who had said yes falls out at the last minute. And so that's also, I don't know if it's frustration, but it's also a real loss. It's very emotional at that point. And you really have to grieve that moment and pick yourself up. And, you know, my dad always used to say it's all about, I mean, I guess everyone's dad says, but it's all about how you pick yourself off the mat and wipe the blood off your gloves and, you know, get back in the ring and keep fighting, you know, so just keep doing that.
What was your biggest role that you've been in, according to you? Like, what were you the most proud about? What role?
I've been so lucky. I've had so many really incredible experiences. I mean, I think you mentioned NYPD Blue at the top. I mean, that was relatively early in my career. And, And I knew instantly that that was going to be a special, special experience. I mean, you know, the late, great Stephen Bochco put together an incredible show. And David Milch, who was a super genius, and this guy, Bill Clark, who was a 12-year Gold Shield in New York, they made this incredible show that now is a little bit dated. I've watched a couple episodes recently. It's a tiny bit dated, but back then it was cutting edge and so exciting. And the writing is so good and smart, and the acting was incredible. And so it had been my favorite show, and I'd auditioned for it a number of times, I think 11 times.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't get one. And I was so frustrated because it was the only show I wanted to do. Mm. And at some point, I got one. It was supposed to be a one-day guest star, and it turned into, I don't know, 9 years of work. It turned into like 30, 40 episodes or something.
Yeah, you were the assistant director, or assistant district assistant attorney.
Assistant DA. Yeah. You know, the writing on that show, the people I was exposed to, the way that they worked, it was such an amazing education. I was so lucky to be a part of that piece. And you know, the people that I learned from, I mean, watching Dennis Franz and Jimmy Smith, you know, working with those two guys, it's like, there's no way you don't get better by working with people who are incredible, you know, and generous and willing to, you know, to even, you know, teach you and help you while it's happening. I mean, when I first walked on the set, I remember just as a fan, I was so blown away that, like, oh my God, here's the precinct. And that's what Dennis Franz really looks like and stuff. And it was almost instantaneous that they welcomed me into the group, and very, you know, within moments, I was all of a sudden, you know, I felt like I was part of that team. And even though I was kind of, you know, I was very, you know, aggressive with the cops, and I guess I was kind of a bad guy because I was always trying to stop them from doing whatever shenanigans they were up to, but they really welcomed me into that troop, and the writing was so good. I trusted them all so much that, you know, I think I don't know if it's the biggest part I've had, but it was certainly one of the most enjoyable, exciting, experiences that I've had on set. You know, that often David Milch was so brilliant, but often he would not have written some of the scripts like while we're there, which is incredibly rare, right? When you're on TV, there's like 90 drafts, and there's, you know, there's the studio and the network and the producers, and everybody's got to take their crack at it. And it's very set. Like every word is set. Yeah. And David was so brilliant. He would he'd call from the racetrack, and you could hear it in the background, you know, you could hear the racetrack, you know, and they're off and running. You could hear in the back, and, you know, and he'd call, and we'd all gather around, and he'd say, hand the phone to Michael. And I'd take the phone, and he'd say what my words were, and I'd repeat them, and someone would write them down in front of me. And then he'd say, hand the phone to Jimmy. And he'd hand Jimmy the phone, and he'd say, and he's coming up with it while he's dictating this on the phone at the track.
Yeah.
And he would dictate the whole scene, and then he'd say, okay, you know, call me later. And he'd go bet. And then we would put the scene together. And it was brilliant. It was just like a beautiful, brilliant scene that needed to happen.
Wow.
That like ties up the whole storyline or whatever it was. I just found that it just blew my mind. I mean, you know, coming from a writing family and knowing what writing is, which is such a discipline and so difficult and takes so much time, and writing is rewriting and stuff. And he would just pick up the phone, and just, it would just come out of his mouth while he's watching a race. It was, that was an exciting place to work.
Oh. Yeah, I was going to ask you, speaking of exciting places, Rick, I was going to ask you what your favorite location was that you've ever been on.
Wow, that's another great question. there's been so many great locations.
You were in Miami, you've been in New York, you've been all over.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I would have to say that I did 3 weeks on Fantasy Island. It was a Fantasy Island reboot with Malcolm McDowell as the lead, as Mr. Rourke.
Yeah.
And it was me, and my wife was played by, what's her name? Oh boy. I forget. She's lovely.
Yeah.
And I was crazy about her, and the whole thing was shot in Maui.
Oh, yeah.
And so we stayed at Maui Four Seasons, and that was just heaven. It was just heaven. You're in Miami, and in Maui, and you're working. And Alyssa Milano. Alyssa Milano.
Oh, yeah.
And I got to hang out with her for 3 weeks, and you know, she was just, I think, freshly married and totally in love with somebody else. But but I just remember that experience was, you know, we hung out as friends.
Yeah.
But it was a really fun experience. Oh. That was a beautiful place to work.
Yeah, that's great. I've been to Maui.
I love, you know, I've done a bunch of stuff in Vancouver. Also Toronto, but even more so Vancouver. I love working in Canada. I love the people. I love the climate. I love the fact that it's not sort of about the industry, and you know, Los Angeles is so industry centric. But I love going up to there. I just got back from Vancouver. I was there for, I don't know, 5 weeks, but I had to quarantine for 2 weeks, and then somebody came up positive on set, so we had to quarantine another week, and then there's a couple of weeks of work, but I didn't get out enough. And Stanley Park is so beautiful. But I got a good episode of The Good Doctor coming next Monday. I guess March 8th.
Yeah, I was going to ask a little bit about that. I know that's the last thing that you've done now, or that's the most. Is that the most current thing that you're working on?
Yeah. I just got back last week, and I think it's going to air next week. It's a quick turnaround on this one, I think, because of the COVID schedule and stuff. But that was an incredible job, and you know, those guys are pretty great up there. The Canadian crews are so on top of what they're doing, and also the attitude of the set is always just, it's more relaxed, and it's not that it's less efficient, but it's a warm place to work. There's not anxiety, and they give you time and care. They make sure you're taking care. I had to do some really emotional stuff, which I can't really talk about yet, but it's a very emotional, sad storyline, and my wife's going through some horrible things, and I'm trying to figure it all out. And they really gave me time. I had to go to some horrible, dark places, and there was just as a guest, often they like turn the camera on you, and they're like, "Go," and they don't want to spend time on you, and they have all kinds of mouths to feed. They have a lot of really talented people who are on that show who all have a bunch of different stuff to do. And often as a guest, you get treated a little bit like a guest. Well, I mean, not like in a good way, like an ugly cousin, maybe.
We're like, yes, they
want to get what you they hired you and they want to get you, but they're not going to spend a lot of time and energy with you. But for this gig, I found that they were really, not only warm, but they just gave me everything I needed. They bent over backwards to make sure I was feeling comfortable and safe to go to these places, and it was just a really warm job, and people I was working with were pretty great too.
Yeah. I know, not too long before that, last year you did Station 19. It's a TV series. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, that was a strange job because Paris Barkley, who I've known forever, I did an amazing pilot with him and long time ago, and we all thought that was going to blow up and be ginormous, and of course it didn't. But Paris has been a friend ever since, and he's one of the EP, he's one of the executive producers on Station 19, and I went back, he was directing this episode, and so I went back on that show. It was the first job back after COVID, and it was just like I said before, part of what's so beautiful about what I do is the connections you make. And I don't mean connections in an industry sort of way, but like the people you connect with and the families that we create and the friendships that are forged and, the relationships when you're in the trenches and you're trying to create something beautiful or, horrible or tragic or whatever, the people who were all involved in that top to bottom, that's a really exciting thing. And I found that working on Station 19, they were wonderful. But they were also very concerned about COVID, as everyone is. And they were following everything, to the letter of the law, which thank God they did. And it just, but unfortunately, as an actor and someone who needs to, connect with people, it was very sterile and very disconnected and isolated and separated. There's no way to really befriend anybody or connect with anybody until they say action, when you tear off your mask and you do your shtick, and then you tear back on your mask and you walk away from everybody. So, I was grateful to be working. It's a great show and it came out well, and I was proud of the work, but in terms of the process of it and making it, it just felt so, I guess, like every job and all parts of life these days, it's just very sterile and antiseptic and not easy. You have to think about everything you touch and everywhere you go. And, that's just for everybody. I mean, that's no different. I just found that working in this environment as an actor and an artist and sort of not being free to move in certain ways or do certain things, it's a hard thing. You really have to be prepared and trust that it's all going to come out. And, there was a bunch of times where I'm acting and the people I'm acting with can't even be there, or they're off somewhere else, or they're you know, where they're hidden behind stuff you can't even see. And, you know, and that, you know, it's a hard thing to create that relationship when they're not really there, you know, but I guess that's what we do. That's what we do.
Then that's what makes you a great actor, Michael. The fact that you can do, you can be thrown into anything. And I know, although it's not ideal, you're really great at it. One of my favorite things that you did, which I watched because I'm a fan of this show, is Supernatural. You were in the Hollywood episode. I think it was Hollywood Babylon or something, right?
Yeah, totally.
It was that season two.
Yes, that was, wow. I mean, I haven't seen that one in a long time. The only real thing, I mean, that was a wonderful job too. I think it was in Vancouver, right? I think.
Yep.
And those guys were great, and you know they had been going a long time, and they ran a really tight ship, and they knew how to tell a story, and you know how to keep their audience. So I was along for the ride, but I also remember at some point I had to be dragged by the devil by my leg across the stage. Yeah, towards the fan. That's right, towards the fan to be killed, I guess. And I just remember screaming at the top of my lungs and being dragged, and my fingernails trying to claw onto anything I could. And they said cut, and the director came over and he was like, "Can you go further?" And so I just remember screaming all day long at the top of my lungs, and my fingernails were broken off from trying to grab onto to the floor. But they were great. I had a lot of fun, and you know, and I was nervous about how that was going to come out. And of course, I guess you saw it, but it was just Supernatural. It was just a lot of fun.
It was great. Did you get the chance to hang out and talk with Jensen Ackles?
Yeah, totally. Those guys were they were really sweet to me. I mean, it was a long time ago, and I was one of 10,000 guest stars who were coming through. Mm-hmm. But they were warm to me. You know, I think they were a bit younger, and those guys were off doing their thing and stuff. And so, you know, they were very caught up, and there was a lot going on for them. And they were very, the show was, hot as ice, or hot as fire. So,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. I did my shtick and I was out, but I had a lot of fun with them. They were pretty great.
So, and I see in your little repertoire here that you did I Am Sam. What was the role that you played in that?
I played the doctor who delivers Sean Penn's baby early on in the very early, like first 10 minutes. And I didn't have much to do, although I had a couple days, and I think they cut a few of the scenes. So it turned out to be, you know, one or two scenes in the film. But the amazing thing about that job was, besides Jesse Nelson, who was the director, who was pretty incredible and so warm to me and, you know, became a friend after that. But watching Sean Penn work for the tiny bit of time that I was able to, was just so incredible. I'm just such a fan of his, and I just watched him. You know, he was completely 100% Sam throughout meeting him, throughout lunch, throughout makeup, throughout the day. I never saw him out of character, and so you know, to have grown up watching this amazing actor, this chameleon, and watching him, you know, and that character was so vulnerable and open and warm and naked. And you know, he'd done so many things that were, you know, so different from that, and just to see his heart out there all day long, it was incredible. I remember had a few interactions with him, you know, as Sam, and you know, in a lunch and whatever, and he just never he just was always that guy, and I was just so blown by his commitment and the depth. And you know, when they would say action, he wouldn't, like, he was already in it, you know, from beginning to end. So there was no change between what he had been doing and what he was doing now, because he was just living that guy. It was pretty intense.
Yeah. So speaking of Sean Penn and the fact that you really liked, you know, seeing his performance, and I'm sure, you know, watching people like that, it's a learning lesson in itself. Who was your favorite person to work with over the years?
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh, I have no idea.
All right, you know what? Top three.
Top three. Okay, well, you know, I just hung out with these boys last night, but I did a bunch of years on Royal Pains as this really fun character named Killer Keller, who's this agent who was really unsympathetic. And every episode I'd have some horrible physical ailment happen to me, from, you know, broken nose, broken arm, my my, you know, my private parts, like all kinds of issues that were going on. They made me wax my entire body a bunch of times for different episodes. You know, the showrunner is my oldest friend, Michael Roush, and he's a wonderful guy, and, you know, my closest friend. And so he, of course, put me in all these awful positions, because they were having fun watching me go through all this, as a side note to the fun of the episode. But working with Michael and also working with Mark Feuerstein, who was the lead and who's like a brother to me, and Ben Shankman, who's also was my college roommate, who was on the show, who is also like a brother, and Roush is a brother, you know, working on that sort of thing, working with people you love. There's nothing like that. I mean, I've been so lucky to work with incredible people. I mentioned, you know, Dennis Franz and Jimmy Smith, you know, and all the people on that show. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you work with like, you know, with a bunch of people who you grew up with and who you went to acting class with and, you know, who you've hung out with and love, there's a real joy to that. There's a real beauty to that. And so, I guess that was one of the most fun experiences. I also made a movie that I directed and wrote with a friend called Love Shack, which is a mockumentary about the porn industry, which is pretty fabulous. No, not many people saw it, but it's pretty funny. It's sort of Spinal Tap on porn.
Yeah.
And so, because I got to do whatever I wanted to do on that, and I had raised the money myself, I cast everybody I loved. And so that experience too, you know, when you're working on a labor of love like that, and you've got people who love you, who are working for whatever they're working for, $100 a day, I guess. Mm-hmm.
So directing and acting, I'm sorry, directing and writing, like you just did there. Is there anything else that you've directed or written that you absolutely just fell in love with?
Yeah, you know, I directed a Royal Pains episode and a couple of Girlfriend's Guide to Divorce episodes, and I've directed a bunch of stuff, a bunch of shorts and plays, and obviously Love Shack and stuff. I love directing, and I feel like it's I'm at my happiest place when I'm directing. I mean, everybody loves directing; it's an incredible job, and I have a lot to learn, and I want to keep doing it. You know, the times have changed a bit, and directing wise, at least in the TV world right now, I'm just not I don't know how to say this, but I'm a white middle-aged Jew male. And so, you know, so times have shifted, and while I respect that and understand it, you know, sociologically I'm a liberal New York Jew, and, you know, my grandparents were obviously, you know, commies and stuff. So I respect the movement of the world and the winds of change that are happening right now. And I really, you know, I hope I'm somewhat involved in it. And I'm certainly trying to, you know, educate my classes and what's happening and where we're at, and try and, you know, and learn myself. But personally, you know, directing has taken a back seat for now, because it's much harder for, you know, they're looking for new voices and for, you know, and with good reason. And so my voice is, you know, isn't in vogue at the moment. So, you know, all that means is I have to really double down on the stuff I'm writing and the projects I believe in, and, you know, keep acting and, you know, and wait for my turn.
Yeah. What my whole podcast is about is that everyone has a story. So I love hearing different views from different people. So
I agree. Everyone has a story. And so, you know, if you're frustrated with your career and you're in this business, tell your story. I mean, that's what I tell my students is there's so many stories out there that haven't been told. And right now, as I was just saying, there's so many new stories that have the opportunity to be told.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's a lot to be frustrated about for young artists, storytellers, actors, writers, producers. Mm-hmm. I agree with you. I think people need to, you know, stop looking to fit into some larger machine and tell their stories, because those are the ones that are, you know, that are making hay these days.
Yeah. And it doesn't have to follow the trending stories. You know, everyone's story is unique and individual, and there's a genre for it all. And, you know, what you just said kind of leads me into another question that I wanted to talk about, or another question that I wanted to ask, which was your teaching. Where are you teaching and what are you teaching?
So I teach acting at Stuart Rogers Studios, which is a really wonderful acting studio out in the Valley, in North Hollywood. And, you know, Stuart and I went to class together at the Beverly Hills Playhouse a million years ago. And, we kind of came up together, and he's always been a good friend and a creative partner. We've done a bunch of things together. And I've been teaching for him for, I don't know, almost 20 years, I think. I love teaching. It's a really vibrant class full of talented, young, ambitious people who are, you know, who are, even in spite of COVID, making strides and growing and finding ways to keep creating and, you know, keep working. And so, you know, I love doing it. It as I said before, it's really good for me to get out of my own way and not think about my own, whatever, money or career or problems or whatever. And just kind of, you know, give back. You know, you don't get paid a lot of money for teaching, unfortunately. I think it's a really noble, amazing cause and skill. And I love doing it. You know, I every time I do it, I sometimes, you know, you're gearing up for it and you're like, oh, I gotta do this. And then you're in it. You know, it's like working out. It's like you're in it and you love it. And when you're finished, you're high as a kite.
Yeah.
You know, it's a really great creative discipline for me, and it gets me out of my own way. And to boot, I think a lot of these kids are, you know, I call them kids, but they're not kids. But I think a lot of them are really growing and involved and expanding. And it's a really exciting, you know, it's an exciting class. I love it.
So is it, do you have a class for beginners as well, like for all different stages?
Yeah. You know, acting is weird that way because, yes, we do that. You know, it's called Foundations class, and then there's a bunch of different classes and stuff, but the truth is that while working on your craft is critically important, everyone comes into it at a different level. And so when you say beginner, it's like some people haven't been exposed to a lot and they haven't done a lot of stuff, but they understand a lot about themselves and what they bring and how to be and how to be present and how to listen and all kinds of things, how to create an environment, how to make, you know, circumstances personal to you, even though we're talking about some, you know, supernatural thing that doesn't really even exist or whatever. You know, there's a lot of knowledge to be learned, but there's some people who come in who understand the process easily. And then there's some people who take a lot longer and sort of watch themselves and have trouble letting go and trusting and listening to those around them and kind of aim at whatever emotion they've identified that they should be feeling. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's it's different for every student. And I really try as best I can to individualize my teaching and kind of put the bar in different places depending on where people are at, and give them assignments or notes or encouragement or wisdom that they particularly need. You know what I mean? Like the whole class needs to understand certain basics and certain fundamentals about what's going on, or how to break down a scene, or how to text a scene, or, you know, how to create something, whatever it is. But each person is at a different level. So it's an imperfect system. Mm-hmm. I think that that my class is filled with people, some of whom could step on a series tomorrow and kill it, and some of whom need, you know, some time to really understand how to break down a scene and what's, you know, and what they can offer to it and how they can make it personal for them.
Yeah, that's great. And you said that's in Hollywood, is it?
It's in North Hollywood, like in the new NoHo Arts Center, which is, at least before COVID, it was really vibrant and a lot of theaters opening up and classes and just a lot of artists up there. You know, I love it. I love it up there. It's, you know, it used to be a kind of weird, bad neighborhood and kind of funky up there in North Hollywood. And it feels like it's all changed and turned around because of all the, you know, because the artistic community has really, you know, taken an interest in that area.
Yeah. Well, so what's next for you, Michael? What do you have? I know we talked about the good doctor.
Yeah, funny you should ask. So the good doctor's done, and I finished a giant writing assignment that I was doing for Audible through James Patterson, which is called The Method, about an actor who books a part as a serial killer and becomes a serial killer. So that should be happening. It should be out by the summer or fall, I guess.
Wow.
But I just finished that, and I finished the poker tournament last night. So the next thing on my docket is I wrote a pilot. That's very personal to me, and I think it's pretty damn good. And I got close to making it a bunch of times, close to setting it up a bunch of times over the past, I don't know, 7 years.
Yeah.
And each time it's been frustrating and, you know, and soul crushing. And then, you know, you go with another company and then they get excited and then they fail and then you do the same thing. So what I did was I raised a little bit of money.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to go shoot this in, I think in April, it looks like we're going to go shoot it in April. And I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to finally get this thing off the ground and at least create some sort of something to be seen and to be, you know, hopefully sold and to maybe tell a bunch of more episodes of the story. Cause I really, you know, I believe in it. I really do.
Do you have anything set up to where people can donate to your cause?
That's such a great question. What I'd rather do is have people, if they're interested, they should donate to the CTF.org for the Children's Tumor Foundation. In terms of the money to go make this thing, the money's raised. We got to use it wisely. Nice. You know, I'd love to have more money, but I also don't want to be beholden to anybody. So, you know, what I'm going to try and do is make this thing on a shoestring and see if I can, you know, if I can pull it off. I just watched this thing the other night. I don't even know if I'm allowed to mention. I can mention
yeah, absolutely.
Things, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I saw this thing the other night called The Assistant with Julia Garner. And this young woman wrote, produced, directed, and edited this film for $1.3 million is what it said on IMDb, which who knows if that's even the real amount. But I was just so blown away by, I just keep being re-inspired by people who take the bull by the horns and go make the piece that they want to make. I felt like this piece was so, you know, it affected me so deeply, and it was such a it was such an incredible feat that she did, and she nailed it. So I feel like if she can do it, I can do it. You know,
yeah.
Why not?
So I guess this where our time is just about up. So I wanted to know how people could follow you, how they could take your class, how they can donate for all these things. So if you just want to give one last plug for all of that,
maybe sure. You know, this is not one of my best things, but. You know, there's my IMDb page, which has all the things that you were gazing at.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm on Instagram, Michael B. Silver, but it's not. But I'm not a pro at Instagram.
I just followed you, by the way.
Oh, great! Thank you very much. I think I might have 9 followers now. But so there's that, and obviously CTF, the Children's Tumor Foundation.org. That's an amazing thing that I already plugged.
Yeah.
And I don't know, you know, the show's called Rabbi Mike, the one that I'm going to go make.
Okay.
And so hopefully you'll see it next year, you know, on Showtime or on Amazon or Netflix. We'll see.
And then The Good Doctor, that's the March 8th, right?
March 8th on ABC. Yeah, it should be a very sad episode. Make sure you got your tissues nearby.
All right. Well, Michael, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for just taking the time out of your day to talk to me. I know it's been
a long time. You, Nikki. You know, I wasn't sure if I could fill your whole slot, but thank you for keeping me on track. I had a lot of fun.
Oh no, it's easy, and I could talk to you all day long. So we'll stay in contact, and I'd like to talk to you more about your classes as well that you have going on over there. I like to learn.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The acting classes, by the way, Stuart Rogers Studios in North Hollywood, and he's got a bunch of classes there. I'm not the only teacher. He's an incredible teacher as well, and it really is a vibrant theater community. There's also a whole theater, the Theater Tribe, which is a theater, you know, award winning theater company that's attached to the studio, and I just find it's great to be around. You know, a group of creative souls who are putting stuff up and creating and networking. And, you know, it's a really vibrant community. So I highly recommend it for anyone who's interested.
Oh, wonderful. That's great. Again, Michael, thank you so much for being on the show. I got to plug my sponsors really quickly. Southern California Jet Skis is a sponsor of mine. They rent jet skis in Oxnard, California. So they're used to the celebs coming up. I can't mention all the cool people that they've told me about, but it's a real fun time. Jet skis and like Tesla boats almost. They're not gas powered, so they're friendly and fun, and you get to see dolphins almost every time. So shout out to SoCal Jet Skis. And if you want to book with them, you can go to SoCalJetSkis.com. Also, Liberty Home Mortgage is a sponsor of mine. If you have any questions about anything that has to do with buying a home, they can help you out. So that is it for me, Michael. I will be in touch. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Nikki. I had a lot of fun.